This is Chef John Falls welcoming you to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio, and inviting you to join us at the kitchen table for another hour of adventures in food. Each week we travel from the back roads of Louisiana to the streets of Europe's capitals, delving into food. We talk with chefs, food historians, authors, and producers. We search out current trends, revive forgotten traditions, and naturally we're going to share a recipe with you. Louisiana's settlement and survival owes much to our German ancestors. Like our German Cajun cooking, our heritage is one of rich flavor and hearty stock. Join me, Chef John Falls, and Glenn Falgu as we talk about Louisiana's great German heritage on Stirring It Up next. But first, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Barbara Klein. International aid efforts in the Philippines appear to be hitting their stride today, more than a week after Typhoon Haiyan. One of the ongoing concerns there, though, is availability of water. NPR's Russell Lewis reports it could take months before the region's water systems are operating normally.
Some filtration systems in Tacloban have started to come online. That's the city in the eastern Philippines most devastated by the super typhoon. The Philippine Red Cross has dispatched tankers to the area. Aid groups are also flying in bottled water to residents. In other isolated areas, the U.S. military is using helicopters to drop water and relief supplies. The aircraft carrier USS George Washington will be able to help as well. The ship's distillation plant is capable of producing 400,000 gallons of water a day. In addition to being hydrated, having a clean water supply is critical to prevent many diseases like cholera and typhoid. Russell Lewis, NPR News, Manila.
Afghan officials say a suicide car bomber struck in Kabul today. They say at least 6 people were killed, 22 others injured. The attack took place near the compound where Afghan elders will gather next week. They're going to debate a proposed security agreement with the U.S. From Kabul, NPR's Sean Carberry reports the site of the bombing is littered with rubble and shattered glass.
The huge blast destroyed cars and shops and scattered debris for more than 100 yards. Witnesses described seeing injured and dead civilians being pulled from the scene. Afghan officials claimed the bomber was under surveillance and exploded his vehicle when stopped at the checkpoint. While the blast took place near the Loya Jirga Hall, which was empty at the time, officials expressed doubts it was the actual target. Earlier in the day, President Hamid Karzai said the Taliban were welcome to join the Loya Jirga next week to discuss the bilateral security agreement. However, the Taliban have long condemned the proposed deal that would keep U.S. troops in Afghanistan after 2014, and they have threatened to attack the Jirga. Sean Carberry, NPR News, Kabul.
In Libya, rival militias continue to clash in a suburb of the capital, Tripoli, after violence erupted yesterday. Armed militias fired on a large crowd of demonstrators who were demanding the dissolution of the unlawful armed groups, killing at least 43 people. Local militiamen are battling fighters from outside the capital as the government struggles to contain the armed militias. Trustees at Princeton University in New Jersey are meeting to decide whether to offer students a meningitis vaccine that has not been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. Yesterday, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said in light of the 7 meningitis cases linked to Princeton, it will allow Bexsero to be imported. The drug is approved in Europe and Australia. This is NPR. California's attorney general says 10 private websites have been shut down for imitating the state's health care exchange. The sites are not being removed from the web. Instead, as NPR's Atna Jaffe reports, they now redirect consumers to the state's official health insurance exchange.
California's exchange is called Covered California. Some of the 10 websites had similar names or used words like exchange in their titles. State Attorney General Kamala Harris warned that these sites would not offer subsidies to those eligible or provide all the consumer protections in the health care law. California forbids solicitations that falsely imply government connection or the use of confusing domain names. California was the first state to start building its health insurance exchange after the passage of the Affordable Care Act. To date, about a third of the people who have signed up for health insurance under the law are Californians. Ina Jaffe, NPR News.
The San Francisco area could be facing another transit strike just weeks after the Bay Area Rapid Transit District and two unions signed a new contract. BART officials say the contract inadvertently includes a provision that gives workers as much as 6 weeks of paid leave under the Family Medical Leave Act. BART officials, who want to go back to the bargaining table, say it's an error that needs to be fixed. Union leaders say BART has buyer's remorse. A majority of the residents of Milford, Texas, are being allowed to return to their homes. They were evacuated yesterday after an oil pipeline exploded and burst into flames. Officials say a drilling crew accidentally punctured the line. A small fire continues to burn. No injuries have been reported. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Kresge Foundation, expanding opportunities in America's cities at Kresge.org.
You're listening to KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, a public service of the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Find us on Facebook at KRVS Public Media.
This week on Local Produce Live, Lost Bayou Ramblers, Bastille. Watch the new video only on KRVS.org. KRVS, keeping South Louisiana music live.
Chef John Falls welcoming you to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. From the swamps and bayous of South Louisiana, thanks for joining us in our little piece of culinary heaven where good cooking is just a way of life. Mornings begin here with a roux simmering in a cast iron pot, and our evenings end with thoughts of what we're going to cook tomorrow. All right, everybody, welcome to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio, the best cultural show on radio, and we want to thank you for joining us at the kitchen table. I'd like to begin by welcoming Michelle York, our executive producer. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you today?
I'm doing good. I notice your desk is a flurry now with cookbook stuff. What's going on in there, huh?
Yeah, you know, getting ready for the vegetable book for next Christmas for everybody.
Now, that's not to be confused with this Christmas.
Yeah, not this Christmas. Christmas 2014.
2014.
I don't want everybody running up to the stores. Now, although we do have a lot of great cookbooks still
absolutely
in the stores, and I'll be signing too this year, even though I know it's not quite Thanksgiving yet, but I mean, you know.
You'll be signing. Yeah. I mean, it's going to be here sooner than you know it.
I know Christmas is next week. I can't imagine it.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's Thanksgiving in a couple of weeks. I'm sorry. Anyway, y'all, yeah, that's great news. I mean, starting to get that book. In fact, as I shot Melitone, we'll talk about that all day.
Because Melitone's one of the critical issues for Thanksgiving.
Absolutely, and I could talk a little bit about Melitone's. That's a whole show, right? But anyway, across the glass wall, Dean Slamo, engineer, keeping the sound balance and our music dynamic and perfectly chosen for every show most of the time.
Oh, goodness.
You got a Melitone song over there?
We might have something like that today. I don't know.
There was a great orchestra over in France that did a song, Melitone, from a Creole composer.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, absolutely. Remember, we had the maestro from the symphony here, and we did Melitone, introduced him to it.
Oh,
yeah.
Neat.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Anyway, y'all, it's a beautiful, my God, it's a beautiful day out there today, huh? Absolutely.
It is.
Great. You know, it's amazing how the seasons just kind of click on and off, huh? I mean, the stores click on and off, the roadside markets click on and off, the gardens click on and off, our wardrobe clicks on and off, like overnight.
Well, I think it's amazing going into the grocery store, not into just a department store, because they get a little eager, and sometimes we have Halloween at 4th of July, and, you know, they need to read the Oodle Madoodle book to get their season straight. But it's great to go into the grocery store because you can see when the season changes, and I love to see the harvest change. All of a sudden, you're seeing pecans, and you're seeing navel oranges, and all of the persimmons, and all the great foods and squashes and pumpkins associated with fall.
There's one food that shouts holidays are here, and no doubt about it, and until you see it, don't even think about it. You know what it is?
What?
Candied fruit.
Oh, that's true.
Candied fruit, because so many holiday cookies and regardless of the holiday need candied fruit. And fruit cake is certainly one of them. Stolen is another one. The little gâteaus, a lot of them are garnished with candied fruit. Huh? Absolutely. Anyway, y'all, it's never, you know, we know it's never terrible to start thinking about what kind of dressing or what kind of stuffing will accompany old Tom Turkey. But I can tell you that all the indecision was removed when I saw, for the first time, I laid my eyes on the gorgeous white Israel Thibodeau melitons. Mm-hmm. I saw them turn ripe. I saw these little pendulums of snow on my meliton vine. They were destined for the false Thanksgiving dressing and obviously into greatness.
I have to say, they are beautiful white orbs. I haven't seen them on the vine, but I've seen them in the kitchen. I haven't actually tasted one yet.
Not yet, no.
They have had some that have been cooked, but somehow they have not found their way to my desk.
Well, you know, there was a long search for the original melitons coming to Louisiana. Many say from the Canary Islands with the Los Islanos. Others say they came from South America. There's been a lot of dispute about it. I'm sure they probably came from both ways. The Indians call them vegetable pears. In France, they call them Christophine. In Spain, they call them chayote. But in Louisiana, we call them meliton. And one of the most famous, relocated by Dr. Lance Hill from Tulane University, was a snow white meliton, believed to be one of the earliest coming to Louisiana. And he named it after the guy growing it over there near Opelousas, Israel Thibodeau. And the Israel Thibodeau snow white melitons, now going into my dressing this year, I'm growing them. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, I think, are growing a white meliton. I'm not sure, but the Israel Thibodeau is the one. So we'll talk more about that on another show, I think.
Absolutely. And since you're going to be making the dressing anyway, I was just kind of thinking that maybe you could make enough for me.
Well, naturally.
For my family table.
Whatever I'm making, it doesn't matter. I could be making chili for Thanksgiving. She said, make enough for me.
Well, as long as you're making it.
She's going to help you put it away.
You know, talking about dressing, if we were living above the Mason-Dixon line, we'd be calling it stuffing instead of dressing.
Yeah. Sure,
and even though we use the terms interchangeably, there's definitely a difference between the two.
Wait, what, stuffing?
Well, the difference is that we make it, first of all, better in the South. That's the main difference.
Yeah, that's number one.
Because we're all about flavor. The other guys do it nice. Conventional culinary wisdom and, I guess, rumor state that stuffing is what goes inside the bird before it's cooked, and a dressing is baked separately and served as a side dish.
Makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. According to the Oxford English Dictionary, the word stuffing dates back to 1538 and is defined as a forcemeat or a farce or a farce, F-A-R-C-I, meaning a stuffing, used to fill the body of a fowl or the hollow, which is when the bone is taken out of the leg, or what do you call a joint of meat, the hollow where the bone used to be in a leg or something. So that's the force meat that goes inside of that is called a stuffing, of course, before cooking, right?
Mm-hmm. Now, dressing was not so well defined and was called the seasoning substance used in cooking, stuffing, the sauce, etc. Some in the South actually say that dressing dresses the table. Isn't that beautiful? Dresses the table.
And it does, but totally erroneous.
Well, it's the Southern Victorian Society that may be credited with the term dressing since it first appeared around the 1850s. The word stuffing just was not genteel enough for Southern ladies. But then I think we'd all agree that it's okay in the end if we say, you know, after the Thanksgiving meal, whew, I'm stuffed. That may not be genteel either.
Anyway, potato, potato, who cares? You know, without it, it just wouldn't be complete if the debate wasn't there. There's some delicious, though, dressings and stuffing recipes from all parts of this great melting pot of ours. And, of course, each region has what they consider to be their traditional version of this stuffing or this dressing. We don't have any proof that there was dressing at the first colonial Thanksgiving, but given the season with its bounty of berries and nuts and wild game and rice and mussels, and I'm sure they had oysters. Certainly they had lobster in that area.
Oh, yeah. Lobster for Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah. I bet there was some version.
Popcorn.
Well, corn goes into dressing. You see that? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm sure there was some version of the mixture there at that first Thanksgiving. On the East Coast, although they're not exactly like our Gulf oysters, they do have some pretty good oysters up there.
They do have some good, some tasty alternatives.
Yeah, they have some good East Coast oysters up there that's pretty doggone good, like Blue Points and Mystics. Mm-hmm. And my favorite, the Ile de Madeleine, which are up
those
around,
are the best.
Up around PEI up there, mm-hmm. Prince Edward's Island. It's the salt that makes the difference. Ile de Madeleine and up on the East Coast and above Canada, of course, is the ice cold waters.
Yeah.
Louisiana has warm Gulf waters, which tend to have a certain flavor in oyster, whereas the ice cold water hardens and firms up the meat at oyster. And the waters are so salty in the Bay of Fundy and that whole area. Needless to say, you got great oysters up there. In the Northeast, you'll mostly hear this dish referred to as stuffing, even if it isn't put inside of the bird.
Well, that's just wrong.
Well, of course, but we've been debating with Northerners for years. I mean, what's the different style? Huh? And at the end of the argument, we go sit down and eat a great meal. anyway, that stuffing's made with breadcrumbs from a variety of doughs. You know, they can use white breads, pumpernickels, bagel. You won't see pumpernickel in a southern dressing. You're just not going to find it.
Pumper what?
Pumpernickel. Fact is, I was invited to a very exclusive dinner at someone's home for Thanksgiving one year. When he brought out the pumpernickel dressing, I walked out.
You walked out.
I walked out without even a curtsy or a goodbye.
Oh, no.
Absolutely.
Or a how do you do?
There wasn't even nothing to it. I said, if they're that rude, they didn't need an explanation. Huh? Anyway, y'all, often that sausage or dried sage eggs added for more of a custard-like texture. San Francisco, of course, has that beautiful sourdough bread that they use in their stuffings, and it gives it a kind of that tangy, acidic flavor. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Very nice.
Well, and it probably won't be a surprise to anyone that in the Southwest, cornbread is used as a base. In Oklahoma, we always had cornbread dressing. Their recipes are a mix of flavors from above the border and below the border. You'll see various chilies like poblanos and Anaheims and jalapenos in their recipes, maybe corn or even chorizo, the spicy sausage.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Midwest, you could expect to see apples in their dressing with wild rice. East Coast, likely to mix in a few dried cranberries as well. But nationwide, I think we can all agree on the trinity of ingredients that have to go in. Not the trinity we know of, but celery, onions, and sage.
Sage does seem to be universal, and it only comes out in many southern homes at this time of year for that. I think if you were to pick all the best ingredients of the ones you just mentioned, you'd have the markings of our dressing. You know, we have the pecans, the rice, and, of course, our unique andouille, which gives our dressing smoky flavor. Gulf shrimp is always possibly a good source of flavor for dressings. Needless to say, special vegetables go into it, like melitar is a great example. I'm thinking of the Israel Thibodeau we mentioned just a minute ago and how delicious that's going to be because I've just cooked some and they're so delicate and so wonderful. I know they're going to be perfect in my dressing this year. And as far as for bread in the South, it's definitely cornbread. And I have some tips for getting cornbread for your dressing just right too. It has to be dry. That's the biggest problem. It cannot be mushy in texture. I like to dry it a day ahead or so. You bake it, you crumble it, you put it in a pan, you cover it lightly, put it on top of the top of the stove if you have a shelf up there. And just let it dry out for a day or two. You cannot dry it too much. That's the good news. And you can even bake it weeks or so in advance, crush it, freeze it, and then a couple days before take it out and do the same thing. Put it on a sheet. That way you don't have to fight everything the last day. And that coarse dried cornbread makes the perfect texture for crumbling into the rest of your ingredients. But the most important in a dressing has to be whether you chop them, whether you pre-cook them, whether you use the water or not. It's all your choice. Gulf oysters. Gulf oysters, y'all. That's it. No doubt about it. Y'all, we'll bring it back to you a little bit later. Don't you dare go anywhere.
Sweet potatoes on Thanksgiving Day. I'm gonna eat on Thanksgiving Day.
Glide through your weekday mornings at 11 a.m. here on the Medicine Ball Caravan. I'm Cecil Doyle. Mondays through Thursdays, we cruise through a fast-paced hour of sounds, both old and new, as well as keeping you up to date with area music and arts. The Medicine Ball Caravan, 11 to noon weekdays here on KRVS.
Hi, this is Nick Forster. Every week in E-Town, we bring together musicians from a wide range of styles for some great live performances and conversation. And we also present the Achievement Award to someone doing outstanding work in their communities. It's an hour of uplifting stories and music each week on E-Town.
Tuesday at noon on KRVS.
When we turn our back, the mailbox gets packed with padded envelopes containing the latest new releases of Celtic and roots-based music. So this week we're going to catch up on some of the latest from established names and get to know some new ones. Hope you'll join me for the Thistle and Shamrock.
Coming up Sunday evening at 6, here on KRVS.
However, I'm convinced, completely, fully, firmly convinced, you're the only one for me.
Yeah, thanks.
Anyway, welcome back, everybody, to Stirring It Up, the best tasting food and culture show on radio. And today we're talking about one of our absolute favorite subjects and seasons. We're talking about Thanksgiving dressings or stuffings and some of the unique ingredients that we in Louisiana and I guess the country love to use. And Michelle, we have a great guest, a good friend, been a good friend of our company for many, many, many years, and a great personal friend as well, he and his family. Why don't you introduce?
And he is quite possibly responsible for the oysters that are going onto your Thanksgiving table.
What do you mean quite possible? Absolutely.
And onto the plates of Revolution and any number of other restaurants in New Orleans. Sal Sinceri is our guest, sales manager of P&J Oyster Company, along with his brother and sister. They run one of the oldest oyster companies in New Orleans, and possibly the oldest company of its kind in the United States, actually. P&J Oyster Company dates back to 1876 with founders John Popich and Joseph Jurisich, starting out cultivating, harvesting, and distributing fresh oysters to restaurants and saloons, as they were called then, in New Orleans. Alfred Sinceri, Sal's grandfather, began as a salesman with P&J. Shortly thereafter, he became a partner in the business. Sal's father eventually took ownership of P&J's and propelled it forward. After five generations, the Sinceri family is still growing the business to one that is respected among the finest restaurants, most discerning oyster eaters in Louisiana and the world. Of course, they remain committed to the highest quality oysters, as we well know, and it is a delight to have Sal with us on the show today. Hey, Sal.
Well, good morning. Thank you very much for having me. This is a fantastic opportunity to just share the joy and happiness about the Louisiana oyster. Thanks for having me.
Well, I tell you, well, first of all, P&J is synonymous with great oysters, not only in the South, but certainly around the country. I know y'all ship a lot of product as well. And I guess I should start off by just asking the question, as we get into the busiest oyster season of the year as far as cooks are concerned, how's things looking for the industry right now? How are things propping up to make sure we have good oysters between Thanksgiving and Christmas here in Louisiana?
I think what people want to realize right now is what is going on with the oyster industry? What is going on with the oyster community? And ever since the spill, we've had a lack of production. So what's going on is people want their product. They want their oysters. This is the time of the year. It gets cold. You want your oyster dressing. You want your oyster soups. You want your casseroles. You want everything there is about oysters. And there has been a lack of production due to the non-production on the reefs, what we've been doing is planting rock instead of little oysters. So every year in September, October, farmers would take the oysters from the public reefs, little oysters, and plant them on their private leases to where we have oysters year-round. Well, we've been hitting on the private lease oysters for many, many years and haven't had the production from public reefs. So it's been a challenge. It's been a challenge. The oysters that are out there are good. They're fantastic. The quality's there. The quantity is not there. I feel confident it's going to get better. Yeah, I guess the analogy to use, a forest fire. So if you have this devastation, it's going to destroy, but it's going to come back strong and flourish. Well, I'm still confident that that's going to happen. It's just taking a lot longer than what we anticipated.
Are y'all able at this point to ship any oysters out of state, or is it just that the availability of product just is not there to sustain the local market at this point, or is there other reasons?
Well, there's a few restaurants, Chef, that might need oysters around here, like Revolution. Make sure you guys got them. And all of our loyal customers that have been around for many, many years. So we haven't been able to take on new customers. We're not shipping like we used to. We just want to maintain and make sure that our guys have the quality product. That's the other thing, is making sure that the quality product arrives at their doorstep. I mean, oyster prices are high. Oyster prices can be as high as, you know, $12, $13 per pound. Now, that doesn't sound, in comparison to some other seafoods, real high. But for us, for oyster people, that is high. And people aren't used to that. You want to go, you know, up to an oyster bar, sit down and have a couple of dozen oysters, and you want to pay, you know, $10 a dozen. Well, that's not the norm right now. But it's going to get better. Quality of product's good. And we're just going to make sure that we're here for the next five generations.
That's great vision into the future. Thanks for sharing that.
Sal, we were talking about the flavor of oysters a few minutes ago. Can you tell how an oyster is going to taste based on the location of the bed?
Typically, in a certain time of year, in a certain area, and depending upon Mother Nature and what's going on, the rainfall and the higher waters from the Mississippi River, you can kind of tell. But it all depends on Mother Nature. That same, and this has changed also due to our coastline, the tidal movements have been a little bit more erratic. You know, it changes a whole lot more compared to what it used to be. You'd have an area that wouldn't have this tidal movement, you know, wouldn't have as much. So the changes of flavors wouldn't occur. Well, now, in the morning, you could have oysters that are salty as could be, and later on, you're going to have a tidal movement, and they're going to be flat because you're going to have inundation of fresh water. But certain areas, yes. Certain areas, certain times, depending upon, you know, the actual temperatures, the water flow, all that dictates what that flavor is going to be.
Sal, one question, just kind of jumping back a little bit to confirm the quality of our oysters, our listeners. You mentioned a minute ago the spill. There was storms a while back that kind of helped devastate the oyster industry as well. We know that Louisiana seafood and shellfish is probably the most tested product in the world, just because our Department of Wildlife and Fisheries and the oyster industry and the seafood industry certainly has demanded that the substantiation of quality be set forth so that no consumer out there has a doubt about the quality of our product. Can you tell us a little bit about the testing of oysters? And I know at Grand Isle there's an oyster station down there where they're seeding oysters. Can you tell us a little bit about those two things that's going on there, the testing and getting ready to build the future of the industry?
Well, it is true. It is true that our product is probably the most regulated product, seafood product there is. And it is a combination of things. First, you had mentioned wildlife and fisheries, no doubt, for the management of our fisheries. But state health and federal, there are more tests I mean, even before this bill, we were highly regulated. But moving forward and since this bill, there's secondary and third testing that is accomplished, and the monitoring is more frequent also. So the combination of all that definitely dictates that we are providing a healthy product. And it's true. I mean, you don't see issues. I mean, issues aren't occurring. We don't have the health problems that people may have thought would be occurring. So, yes, definitely, highly regulated and quality product. Everyone can be assured that the Louisiana oyster is certainly fit for enjoyment year-round.
Right. Now, one thing I mentioned, that oyster program that's going on at Grand Isle with Wildlife and Fisheries, you mentioned that the oyster seeding would come from the public reef areas into the private reef areas. What's going on with the seeding again to rebuild the whole oyster industry? Is that station out at Grand Isle a big part of it? What's replacing the fishermen who used to reseed by going to the public beds and getting these oysters? How has that changed?
Well, we've had the Grand Isle operation going on for over 20 years, and we've sort of dabbled in the whole process of creating larvae and creating the spat and creating the culch that is derived from this type of plant. And it's similar to how the East and West Coast have done it and had to do it, you know, over the years. I mean, that's what they rely upon. The only concern that we have is that it's not big enough. I mean, we need Grand Isle duplicated 100 times over to make a dent in the type of production that is demanded from Louisiana. We're the number one producer of oysters in America. We provide about 35 to 40% in a given year of all consumed oysters. So Grand Isle is doing a great thing. And, you know, after all these years of research and development, it's working, but we just need to, you know, turn it into 100 times larger to be able to utilize what they're doing. And it does work. But what we're doing on our end and what Wildlife and Fisheries has done to help in the production of oysters is that we have been planting rock and aggregate. That's what that is. It's aggregate. It's culch. And we have been doing this for over 160 years, actually, periodically. And what that is we take rock, because we don't have little oysters from the public reefs, and we plant them onto farming areas, privately owned farmed areas. Now, some work have worked over the past few years, and many have not. And that has been a concern. But again, Mother Nature, I feel confident, is going to do its course and replenish and get back to what it used to be. But then we got, John, you know, we got the coastal restoration coming up. And that is a big concern for me, because we're going to have these large freshwater diversions that aren't scientifically based. We don't have the science behind it that's going to dictate that it will work. So we're going to devastate areas where these freshwater diversions are pointed towards. And again, it goes back to oysters have been a major, major part of our fisheries. The development and management and the farmers, the hardworking farmers, have been working diligently for 160 years to plant and to farm and to put back into our coastline and put back. And what that generates is oyster reef, and oyster reef generates the spawning areas and habitats for all these other fisheries. So what's it going to do to our culture? What's it going to do to the historical food culture of our state?
Well, you know, Sal, you said something very interesting, though. You know, I'm very good friends with folks on the West Coast in the industry. And in Monterey Bay, the sardine industry just was I mean, all these generations and generations of sardine fishermen from Sicily that had come to settle Monterey Bay for 100 years. I mean, packed all the big canneries to pack sardines was in that area. Then all of a sudden, one day, the sardine disappeared. Nobody quite knew why. Nobody knew what had happened. The abalone trade on the West Coast, I mean, all of this beautiful abalone, all of a sudden this shell animal-like oysters started to disappear. The good news is the sustainability of our waters and the sustainability of planet Earth, I guess, is just so forgiving. You mentioned that the good news is that you feel Mother Nature kind of takes care of herself, even no matter how bad we treat her. She normally comes back because the sustainability of a body of water as big as the Gulf of Mexico or of our ocean certainly has the ability to sustain. So I think, as you say, we all have the right to be tremendously concerned with anything new and different, whether science says one thing and Mother Nature may say another. I guess at the end of the day, there's good folks like you, there's good folks like your brother and sister in P&J's and other guys in the oyster industry keeping tabs on everything going on in the industry. And just like a show such as you being the guest today informs our public as to what's going on, and they have a voice as well. So certainly everything that you're talking about is of great concern. And look, the supply of oysters to the cooking community, whether it be the home-based cook or whether it be the restaurant cook like ourselves, my God, oysters is like onion, celery, bell pepper on our plate. It is difficult to cook Louisiana gumbos or Louisiana oyster stews. I mean, if you look at my menu at Revolution, there's five areas that has oysters. And with the emerging roasted oysters, grilled oysters, oysters on the half shell, I had a group in my restaurant last night from Canada. In fact, one of the great, great restaurateurs and managers of the Shangri-La Hotel chain, which is one of the top luxury hotel chains in the country. And he says, I am an oyster lover. And he says, I've been in New Orleans for the last 3 days. And he says, every day I've sat to a table to eat what I consider to be the finest oysters I've ever put in my mouth. Now, this is a guy who knows his oysters. Let's jump quickly, because I know we're running short on time here. How's our orders coming in for the Thanksgiving season? You're starting to see things. I know you're panicking, obviously, on your ability to fill all the customers who are depending on your great quality. But how's things going?
Well, it's a day-to-day situation. Again, we take care of the restaurants first. Then we have two retail outlets for our oysters, and that's Dornach and Langenstein's. So we want to make sure that those guys, because they're with us year-round, just like you guys are with us year-round. And then at that point, it's kind of day-to-day. If we have them, we're going to let people know, that morning or the day before what's going on. But again, purchasing quality oysters is key. And purchasing and providing the customers the quality pack, the type of, oysters themselves, that's a big part. We want to make sure that the oyster itself is the measurements right, the pack's right, and the quality's there.
I've got your book, the P&J Oyster Cookbook, and I was just kind of wondering when you were going to make this P&J Oyster Sausage and Pecan Dressing for
us. She wants to come by and get the dressing.
This is the most important question of today. This is a beautiful dish.
I'm not responsible for the dressing for the family dinners. I'm responsible for a couple other things like marinated oysters. But I love that dish. That is, I'm telling you, it is incredible. It's in our book, sausage, pecan, it's got everything. And to me, the only change, because I used to do oyster dressing, and the one thing that I did different than my mom is I toasted the French bread and scraped the edge of the bread, and that was it. That was the only difference. Everything else in that cookbook That recipe is incredible.
Well, it looks incredible.
Yeah, it looks
it really
beautiful. And we're going to have all of P&J's information. And, of course, we're going to have the cookbook on air as well. And as Sal said, you may not be able to get all arches you want from P&J's this year, but we have a good feeling that if you're going to get the best arches you're ever going to get, you're going to get them from P&J's this year, if you're lucky enough. And I'm going to tell you right now, Sal, you better have my couple gallons on the side, because I tell you what, without them, I'm not going to have a very thankful Thanksgiving.
You got that right. You got it, Chef. No doubt.
Thank
and
you,
remember,
man.
Eat oysters, love, and live longer.
Thank you.
Know that.
Thank you, man. And happy Thanksgiving to you and the family.
And happy birthday.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, y'all have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
All right, guys, we're going to be back in a minute. Don't you dare go anywhere.
Bread and gravy, lots of bread and gravy.
The city of Beirut is a haven for rockers, rappers, Bedouin pop stars, and art music innovators. The music is almost as complicated as the politics. Hello, I'm Georges Collinet. Join me for a hip-deep tour of Beirut, Lebanon today on Afropop Worldwide from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday night at 8 on KRVS.
Hi, this is Bill Bowens from The Dirty Rice Show, inviting you to join either Mr. Lee Klein, Peter, or myself every Saturday night from 8:30 p.m. until 10 p.m. for Dirty Rice right here on KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, Public Radio for Acadiana.
Greetings. Move to KRVS every Sunday night for 2 hours of hardcore classic Rasta reggae radio right here on Jamon. Jamon, Sunday nights 9 to 11 p.m., Saturday mornings 1 to 3 here on KRVS, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Oyster catcher, busy fishing on the lucky shore. Stumbled on an oyster bed he'd never seen before.
All right, everybody, welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best tasting food and culture show on radio. And today we're talking about Thanksgivings, especially Thanksgiving dressings and stuffings. And before I get to the big recipe today, I want to, first of all, thank Sal Sincere from P&J Archie Company for being with us. And, of course, his great family cookbook. I see you perusing that recipe over there.
Yeah.
You like that?
Yes, I do. I can't get off this one picture. That's beautiful.
Gloria, what other books do you have? I mean, do you have anything?
Well, yeah. Well, first, let me finish telling you about this one, the P&J Oyster Cookbook by Kit Wall and the Sinceri family. As we were saying, they've been selling the best oysters around for years and years and years, finally decided to compile their favorite family recipes and favorite recipes from New Orleans restaurants who use P&J oysters. I love that it's organized by prep method because that makes it so convenient. You know, basically you have one ingredient, so how do you want to prepare it? Great photographs, just really, really like this book. The next book that I think is definitely noteworthy is a book called 50 Stuffings and Dressings. This was written by Rick Rogers. Collection of recipes inspired and influenced by a lot of international cuisine, as well as regional favorites, too. He uses meats, he uses breads, fruits, vegetables, all to create dishes that work well with just about any entree you want. Chicken, pork, fish, recipes that you'll use all year long. And then finally, another nice little book for the library that I'd like to mention was written by Terry Pishnoff Werthner, entitled In a Cajun Kitchen, full of wonderful, old, authentic Cajun recipes. There's an entire chapter that's dedicated to dressings, potatoes, and grits. Now, that's a book after my own heart. So if you're kind of searching for what dressing you want to do, there are three books right there that'll help you make that choice for your Thanksgiving. We'll have all of them on our website. So that's the P&J Oyster Cookbook, 50 stuffings and dressings, and In a Cajun Kitchen, all on our website, jfoles.com.
In a Cajun Kitchen, this is an interesting book. I mean, it's almost like a genealogy of a family, because when I look at the LeBeau family is where the book came from an 1815 family of recipes, I guess, but the name kind of threw me. I was looking for a Boudreaux. I was looking for a Thibodeau, and I found Werthener. I guess that's a good Louisiana name.
It is now.
Well, I tell you what, the book certainly, In a Cajun Kitchen, certainly reflects a lot of the history, and looks like a lot of great family recipes, etc. Anyway, Slama, what about that Facebook page of ours? Anything happening? Anything lighting up over there?
Man, our social media is on fire.
Our social media is on fire. I don't see smoke over there.
So let me introduce it real quick. We're at facebook.com/stirringitupradio. The STIRRIN It Up Radio. And that is where you can come on by and give us some shout outs or tell us a little something that's happening in your life. We're always looking for a good subject to have the good chef go on about, because we got this treasure trove of knowledge over here. But we've been getting some shout-outs, some notable shout-outs. Old Dr. David Hubble.
Oh, old David Hubble. What's he talking about?
He wanted to give a little shout-out to a little bit of family. He said his cousin Paul Robert just became the chef at Besh Steak earlier this month.
Oh, is that right?
I'll be darned.
So he wanted to give a little congratulations, Paul, shout-out.
Sure.
I didn't realize Paul was Hubble's cousin. That's good. You know, he's president of our Stovehound Club, David Hubble.
Dr. Hubble.
Yeah. So. Anyway, y'all, so go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/StartingItUpRadio. You know exactly where it is. And share with us, of course, some of your ideas, some of your thoughts, some conclusions you may have come to about why you quit listening to us. I mean, why you listen to us. You know what, you're looking at me like that for, Michelle.
Well, you act like we're losing audience members.
Well, no, I'm just saying, if somebody did, man, our listenership is way up. We're
celebrating
our 17th year.
And our 800th Facebook friend.
You see what I'm talking about?
Look at that. We got 800 friends.
And we just
friends.
Started last Saturday. Last Saturday we just started. Huh?
That ain't half bad.
You doing a recipe today?
I'm doing a recipe. What are you talking about? I have my pecan rice dressing. I have my Israel Thibodeau Melitón shrimp and cornbread dressing. And I have my cornbread and andouille dressing. Which one you want? The cornbread dressing with andouille, or you want the Israel Thibodeau Melitón dressing? Which one you want?
Which was the first one?
The Israel Melitón. Anyway, y'all, we've been talking about Israel Melitón, but Israel Thibodeau just passed away August the 22nd. 2013. He lived in Opelousas, and he was a native of a little town called Bosco, but of course a longtime resident of Opelousas. He died, as most Cajun men of 87 do, surrounded by family. He was a hard-working man. He worked for the ice plant in Opelousas as a young boy, and he was always called after that. He was always known as the Iceman.
Aww.
He was the Iceman, Israel Thibodeau. He then went to work for the Universal Electric Company for 15 years. But after he retired, he started his hobby of raising rabbits.
Oh,
well, there's a natural progression of a Cajun man. You know, you're born, you speak a little French, then you revert to English somewhere along the way. Then, of course, you go to work, you find two or three great jobs you love, and you stick with them most of your life. And then, of course, you retire and you raise rabbits. And after you raise rabbits, then he got involved in his beautiful garden. And he was an avid gardener, and he was successful in growing the extremely rare white vegetable pear, or melitón, as we call it, named in his honor by Tulane University and Dr. Lance Hill. That variety now bears the name the Israel Thibodeau. It's the only pure white, and when I say pure white, I mean snow white, melitón known to be grown in the United States of America. And I am so lucky to have the Israel Thibodeau seed melitons planted at White Oak Farm. And this year, the first year of cultivation, I've harvested well over 100 of them, close to 100 anyway, off of the first year, which is unheard of. Normally, you only get about 30 melitón off of a vine, because most people know it is in the squash family. It grows on a vine like a melon. and they're about the size of a large apple. In fact, the largest one I picked this year was almost a pound and a half, which is incredible. We will have pictures loaded up, but here's the recipe. You ready?
What you been doing with all those melitons?
I've been hoarding them.
How long they keep?
Oh, they keep forever.
You got them in the root cellar?
Yeah. So anyway, let me tell you about the Israel Thibodeau Meliton shrimp and cornbread dressing. The first thing you're going to do, of course, is to get 5 cups of super dry cooked cornbread. And you can use that Jiffy Mix or whatever. You don't have to make it from scratch. We give you a couple of good recipes.
You said stale, too.
Yeah, stale. That's what I'm saying, stale. That's why you want to cook it well in advance. And then once it's cooked, then you can freeze it. Like I say, you know, you can actually go ahead and cook your 5-6 cups of cornbread now, crush it, put it in the freezer. And then, you know, a couple days before, like Wednesday or Tuesday before Thanksgiving, you take it out, lay it on a cookie sheet in the kitchen, and just let it dry out. You're going to take 6 melitons, peeled, seeded, and diced, quarter-inch dice, 2 pounds of a 70-90 count shrimp, that's 70-90 to a pound, peeled and deveined, 5 cups of cooked cornbread, crumbled and divided, and 1 quart of chicken meliton stock. I boil my meliton, of course, in the chicken stock, which I'll get to in a minute. Now, you're going to start off by preheating the oven at 350 degrees. In a large stock pot, you're going to bring this chicken stock, quart and a half of chicken stock, to a simmer. And then you're going to add the diced meliton. The 6 melitons is going to give you probably about 4 or 4.5 cups of diced meliton. And they're about the texture of a potato at this point. You're going to put it in the water, and you're going to boil them until they get very nice and tender and almost to the point of mushy. You cannot overcook them. It's going to take about 30 minutes.
Let me ask you something. You said diced. Are they hard to dice?
No, they're like cutting an apple or cutting a potato.
Okay, so you don't need
same texture.
You don't need to boil them whole and then dice them.
You can, but this makes it easier for our dressing.
Gotcha.
You're going to remove it from the heat. You're going to strain the liquid, and you're going to reserve that stock because now your chicken stock has taken on the flavor of the meliton. So now you have a meliton chicken stock. You're going to drain those cubes, and you're going to mash them very well, like with a potato masher, until they're nice. I like mashed potatoes. Just set them off to the side. Now, in a heavy-bottom Dutch oven, you're going to melt that butter we talked about, that 1/4 pound of butter, over medium-high heat. You're going to add that 1 cup of onions, 1 cup of celery, 1 cup of bell pepper. Well, it's 1/2 cup of red, 1/2 cup of green bell pepper, 1/2 cup of yellow bell pepper. I like that color in it. 12 cloves of garlic, thinly sliced. And you're going to add all of that to the melted butter, and you're going to saute until wilted. About 5 to 7 minutes is all it needs to be, because remember, this is going to be a baked dressing, so you don't have to cook it all the way through. Mm-hmm. You with me?
Yeah, I got you.
So all your seasonings are cooked in the butter right now, right? The meliton is nice and tender, and now you're going to add the shrimp until pink and curled. And remember, you have 2 pounds of 70-90 shrimp, which you can get from any one of your seafood suppliers. Once they turn pink and curl, of course, the shrimp are going to add water or liquid to the mix at this point. You might want to continue to cook it until the water evaporates out. You don't need to dry it out, obviously, because you're going to add a little stock anyway. You're going to add the sage, and of course, you have 1 tablespoon of rub sage. There's the sage going into that dressing again.
And it's not that much.
No, just 1 tablespoon. Sage is a powerful herb. Mm-hmm. And of course, sage grows beautifully in Louisiana, so you can also have a little pot of sage that you grow in your back patio there. 2 tablespoons of chopped basil goes into it, 1/2 cup of thinly sliced green onions, and 1/4 cup of chopped parsley. So you kind of put all of that in, and you cook it around. Then you add the mashed meliton to the shrimp mixture. And again, now you're going to cook, because the meliton is going to have some liquid in it. There's liquid in there, so you're going to reduce it about 50%. And then you're going to continue to stir it and season it with salt, pepper, granulated garlic. You want to simmer that mixture for about 15, 20 minutes. And you can add a ladle of that meliton stock, chicken stock that you boil the melitons in, to keep it moist, and then boil all of the liquid out. Do that again. Boil all of the liquid out. That'll add a really good, rich, fortified flavor to it. You follow what I'm doing there?
Yeah, you put stock and then you boil it away so that it's adding extra flavor.
As it reduces, that meliton shrimp stock reduces, the water evaporates, but the flavor remains. You with me?
So you don't overcook it by doing that?
No, because you want to cook it away anyway. You're making a stuffing.
Huh.
You just want to mash it all up. And the shrimp are not going to be a problem. They're just going to remain, you know, that texture. Now you want to make sure you have some liquid in there. You want the equivalent in your melaton dressing right now of about a cup of visual liquid in there. You know, when you put that last ladle or two of stock mm-hmm. and you boil it out. Well, you want to make sure that you keep about a cup of that nice stock in the bottom of that pot of melaton, shrimp and onions and sage and all of that. You with me?
Mm-hmm.
Because now you're going to add 3 cups of cornbread. And, of course, you know what's going to happen immediately, right? It's going to suck up all of that juice, huh?
Yeah.
Now you got a nice stuffing that's kind of adhering together. Now you're going to add additional cornbread as needed to absorb that liquid, or if it's too dry, you add a little bit of your stock, because you want it to be almost of a pudding mixture, you know, something similar to that.
Uh-huh.
In a separate bowl, you're going to whisk together the eggs. There's a couple of eggs that go into that, one or two eggs. Then you're going to add a little bit heavy whipping cream, if you wish, you know, just kind of cream it out. You're going to add that in, and then you're going to mix it into the casserole. Put it into a baking dish, and if you put it in a baking dish, then you top it with the rest of your cornbread, because you reserved another 2 cups off to the side.
I got you.
And then you put it into that 350-degree oven. If you wish, you can use it as stuffing and put it inside of the bird. Remember to go ahead and season it nicely. Salt, pepper, granulated garlic. Everything is always seasoned to taste. You with
Question.
Me? What's that?
So if you put it in the bird, isn't there some rule about that? Hot stuffing in a cold bird or something?
Well, I always put hot stuffing right out of the pan into the bird, but I go right into the oven. The mistake people make is they'll take hot stuffing, put it into the bird, truss it, tie the leg together. Then they say, okay, we're going to cook it tomorrow. Now that hot stuffing inside of that bird starts to create that bacteria between the cold meat on the inside of the cavity. Mm-hmm. With the hot steam, and it spoils the inside of that bird, especially with shrimp.
Gotcha. Because
there's shrimp in it, and shrimp will spoil immediately if it's not chilled totally. So if you want to make this stuffing or dressing a day ahead of time, even without stuffing it into the bird, I would spread it out on a cookie sheet, allow it to sit at room temperature at least an hour, and then I'd put it in the refrigerator and stir it every hour to make sure it's totally cool. And then I'd go ahead the next day and stuff it into my bird. But don't be afraid to stuff hot right out of the pot dressing into the bird, as long as it's going immediately into the oven, because in 2 hours, 3 hours, it's going to be cooked anyway, right? And the stuffing hot will help to cook the turkey from the inside, because normally with an ice-cold mm-hmm. stuffing in the bird, it takes a while to get that stuffing hot in the oven, whereas putting it in hot will already get you started, right? Season a bird really well, y'all, and whether you're using a duck or a goose or a turkey or whatever it is, even a pork roast, this is the perfect dressing to go alongside that great dish.
Mm-hmm.
Are you with me? You think you can make this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do.
Huh?
I do. Well, I don't know that I'm going to do it, you know, stuff it in the bird. But.
Well, I tell you one thing now. I wanted to see if you would catch this.
Oh, what?
Oysters in place of shrimp. Oysters, because, you know, we're talking about oysters with salad, huh? We want to make sure that we're chopping those oysters up in the place of that shrimp. Same exact recipe. Just put in a couple quarts of PJ oysters into it. Oh, my God. Man, do we have a lot to be thankful for. Y'all, see you next week.
Hi, everyone. This is Pat Mitchell-Worley, co-host of Bill Street Caravan. Join us next week as we get down and dirty with the Oblivions and Bobby Rush. Robert Gordon will continue his discussion on the history of high records. That's all coming up next week on Bill Street Caravan.
Saturday night at 11 here on KRVS.
Le rendez-vous des Cadiens du Théâtre Liberté à Yunis est rendu possible en partie par Le Best Stop Supermarket de Scott.
Underwriting for Rendezvous des Cajuns live from the Liberty Theater in Eunice is provided in part by the Best Stop Supermarket in Scott.